Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody, and welcome on this Sunday afternoon, the Ron Brooks Show. And, you know, it's been a pretty intense week. This is my fourth day with four shows in a row. So I hope you're still engaged. I hope you're still excited. I hope you're still here. All right, so today we do this once a month. Anybody, I think, above a certain amount on Patreon gets to propose a topic. And then everybody gets to vote on that topic. So I've got a whole list of topics here that people have proposed, and then people have voted. So I've basically put them in order of the voting. I think some of the topics kind of integrate nicely, so I won't necessarily go through the exact order on which people voted on them, but I will get to I'll get to the top. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But I'll get to the top four or five in the order, in the ranking, in terms of what people voted on. So if you want to participate, if you want to propose topics for me to discuss on the show, then become a Patreon supporter. You can do so on patreon.com/YaronBrooksShow. Become a monthly subscriber. You can also give a one-time contribution at paypal.me, YaronBrooksShow. Also, so we will cover, I don't know, 5, 6. We'll see how far we get in this. I'm ready to talk about the first 10, but we probably won't get to all 10 of them. You know, if your topic didn't get chosen or didn't get, I didn't cover it this today, then next month propose it again, and maybe more people will vote for it, and maybe it'll rise up in the rankings, and we'll get to the point where I cover it. So, you know, it's great to have you guys asking questions, because this way I'm addressing, I think, things that are concerning to you and concerning big issues. This is an opportunity not to just ask a little concrete question, but actually ask some meaty questions. And we start off with a very meaty question. So this is great, because this will frame all of our discussion today. And actually, I integrate this with some of the stuff that we've been talking for months about, because this is such a key question to everything. It's phrased a little differently, but we're going to broaden the question, because I think it's such an important question. Okay, here it goes. What is the best way to go about explaining the value of principles and long-term goals in the world of pragmatism and short-termism? How best to point out how impractical and harmful the practical approach can really be? Now, this is crucial, because this is really, I think, one of the most important questions that we face today, because we're really facing a world today that is dominated by pragmatism, short-termism, emotionalism. We've talked about tribalism, but really what they all are united around is a lack of any kind of principled thinking. Indeed, not only a lack of principled thinking, a rejection of the very idea that principled thinking should be valued, that principled thinking has any virtue or value. The world is too complex, we are told, to think in principle. You know, you have to take into account the circumstances, the specific nature of everything going on. You can't make generalizations. You can't actually think in broad generalizations, which is what principles are. Now, I'm going to give my answer to this, and the answer that I'm going to give you is very much based on, on a particular essay that I would encourage everybody out there to read. Anything I say, I've learned from Dr. Peikoff and Ayn Rand, and Leonard Peikoff addresses this question in one of his most important Foothold Forum talks that he ever gave, which is available for free online at the Ayn Rand Institute campus. And the name of the talk was "Why Should One Act on Principle?" Why should one act on principle? So, if you listen to my whole presentation here today, Even if you think you've learned something from my presentation here today, go read this essay, because this is one of the most important essays in objectivism you will read, and it's really crucial. It's at AynRand.org/campus, or just do a Google search on why should one act on principle Peikoff, and it's the first thing that pops up is the essay, the link to Ayn Rand campus, where this essay, where this is, and you get a transcript of the essay, even though this was given as a talk. And it's not really a transcript. It's actually an edited essay, because what happened to this essay is it ultimately landed up in Philosophy Who Needs It, that collection of essays that includes Ayn Rand's talk on Philosophy Who Needs It. It also includes includes this. So I encourage everybody to read it. It was given at the Fort Hope Forum in Boston on April 24th, 1988. And then it was published, of course, in 1989 in The Intellectual Activist, and ultimately in 2011 it was only published in Why Businessmen Need Philosophy. I thought it was in, Philosophy Who Needs It. No, it was published in Why Businessmen Need Philosophy, The Capitalist Guide to the Ideas Behind Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. Now, there's a book you should all buy. It's on Amazon. Why Businessmen Need Philosophy. Go to Amazon, get that book, and of course, this essay is there, and the reason it's in that collection primarily is because businessmen are often the ones to argue from a pragmatic perspective. Why should we think of principle? Life is too complex. Generalizations don't work. What we really need is to think concrete by concrete, example by example, case by case. Now, When I reread the essay because of the question being asked, I started really laughing out loud because of the example he uses. Now, this is 1988, and the example he uses right off the bat, like in paragraph four, I'm going to read you the example. I'm going to read from it because it just shows that, you know, all the work we do, nothing changes. Nothing changes. Okay, here's the example. Suppose, for example, that some American businessmen are upset about Japanese sales in the U.S., which they feel are cutting into their own sales, and they go to the government for relief. You know, just replace Japanese with Chinese, and here we are. We're exactly today, 1988. Today, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. And of course, he says, Just to be clear that my position on trade is the same as Dr. Peikoff's position on trade. Of course, if they came to me, I would say, this is not to me, but to Peikoff, you must decide whether you advocate the principle of free trade or the principle of protectionism. Then I would offer a proof of the evils of protectionism, showing why it will harm everyone in the long run, American businessmen included, and why the principle of free trade would ultimately benefit everyone, or everyone productive. That would be the end of the dilemma, and the people demanding tariffs would be sent home packing. Wouldn't that be cool if it was that easy, right? So what I've been trying to do over the last months, right, is to say the evil of protectionism, of the principle of protectionism, it's evil. And then there's a principle of free trade, and it's right. It's always right. Long term, it always works. And it doesn't matter if they're Chinese or Japanese, and it doesn't matter if it's cars or steel, and it doesn't matter if it's software or anything else. It always works. That's what a principle is. And, of course, what I get in reply is exactly what the unprincipled mentality, the pragmatist mentality, feeds you back. But this time it's different because the Chinese are subsidizing the steel industry. So are the Japanese. The Japanese arguably were subsidizing all their industries and protecting them in all kinds of ways. No, this time it's different because the Chinese have tariffs on American goods. Well, but that's always been the case. You know, the whole argument about free trade initiated came from the whole idea. You know, now Seth Martinez is saying, well, what if the Nazis did it? But the Chinese are not the Nazis. So what relevance does that have? And of course, now he says, well, what about the intellectual property theft? But But I've already addressed intellectual property theft. The principle of intellectual property is a principle. You don't trade with thieves. So if something is based on intellectual property theft, you ban that product. I have to say this 3,000 times. It doesn't sink in because, again, people can't think in principles. They hold it as concretes, and concretes you forget, and you can't hold the concretes. You can't hold 1,000 concretes. Where do you draw the line? It's simple. If a product is based on the theft of intellectual property, it shouldn't be sold in America. That's it, period. That's where you draw the line. Is China a threat to the United States like Nazi Germany was in World War II? No. Now, if you want to talk foreign policy, we can talk foreign policy, but that's a different question. And again, if it is a threat, then ban all products from China. But again, that doesn't violate the principle of free trade. Free trade, the principle of free trade, is the idea of trading with countries that are not a physical threat, military threat to the United States. It's a principle. And it was a principle with Japan. And I'm sure people in Japan at the time said, well, the Japanese copy everything and they steal our IP. And you know, the Japanese, they once were an enemy. They could theoretically be an enemy again. And they're buying our golf courses. That was the big deal when the Japanese wanted to buy golf courses. So look, I'm not gonna talk about Chinese trade. The point is that what you're really seeing, and I knew this, but when I read Leonard's article, it just boom, hit home, like Leonard always does to you. It makes everything clear. I'm debating principle people who can't think in principle. And this is true when we talk about the nature of Donald Trump. I'm talking to people, I don't know about you guys, who can't think in principle. So Donald Trump is a committed, thoroughly committed pragmatist. He is an anti-intellectual, anti-principles, unprincipled pragmatist. That's what he is. That's his nature. And that appeals to a broad segment of the American population, including some people who think of themselves as objectivists, because they too ultimately do not think in principle and are afraid to think in principle. The world is too complex. Things have changed. The left, oh my God, the left is coming. We need to be afraid, so we need to abandon principle in order to save ourselves from the left. And one of the questions I have, so the number five question, let me just quickly take it here. The number five question was, what is Dr. Peacock's reaction to Trump? Now, Leonard is, for example, on the issue of immigration, is much more sympathetic to Trump than I am. As you know, I've debated Leonard on immigration. We disagree on this point. But because he's convinced that all these people coming in, they ultimately vote Democratic, and he views that sometimes, not always, he views Democrats as the number one threat, and we need to stop them now, and therefore we need to restrict immigration. So, but what I can say about Leonard's response to Trump, without, I think, risking anything and without speaking for him, because I don't want to speak for him. But the conversations I've had with Leonard, the one thing that comes across is his disgust, utter disgust, with Trump's anti-intellectualism, pragmatism, blatant lying, blatant deception. So that aspect of Trump, put aside the policy where, he might be more sympathetic to Trump on immigration. I'm obviously very opposed to Trump on immigration. But on his character, on his thinking, I hate to call it thinking because I don't think he does much thinking, right? He condemns Trump thoroughly, right? Trump is a pragmatic, anti-intellectual, anti-principle politician. Maybe the most pragmatist politician ever. And I think that would be representative of Leonard's view of Trump. But again, all the caveats, he would probably say it better. He would say it differently. He would have much more to say about it. And I do not in any respect speak for Leonard Peacock. But I thought since that was a question that was asked and it got quite a few votes, I would cover that in the context of talking about principles. I told you this principle issue covers a lot. So it's exactly because every country out there whether it's Mexico or Canada or South Korea or China or Germany or Brazil or Vietnam, which used to be an enemy of the United States. Each one of them, you know, is a specific concrete. Each one of them have different industries. Each one of them subsidize different industries. Each one of them have tariffs on American goods, but at different levels. Each one of them is different. And the way today we deal with trade, and this is why I'm against, you know, bilateral deals or multilateral deals or any kind of deals around trade. The way we deal with trade is we look at each one and we say, okay, you know, for Korea, we'll raise the tariffs like this and we'll lower this. And there's no principle, zero principle. The principle is a lack of principle. The principle is that we're for protectionism and we're going to decide to what extent to implement it based on which gang of businessmen or which gang of cronies or which gang of special interest groups or pressure groups shouts the loudest. Or in Trump's case, we will make the decision based, or in many politicians' case, on who can muster the most votes against us or for us. That's how we'll decide on tariffs and on trade. And my view is I have a principle. That principle is called free trade. It's a principle in economics that Adam Smith proved 240 years ago. It's a principle that since Adam Smith did it 240 years ago, has been reproved over and over and over again with new examples and accommodating the evolving theoretical basis of economics over and over again by economists as diverse as Mises. Keynes was pro-free trade, and even Paul Krugman was ultimately, you know, in his past pro-free trade. But Milton Friedman, Mises, Hayek, so the Austrians, the Chicago school, but even many of the so-called leftist schools, all were consistently have proven over and over again the theory of and the principle that free trade works, that it is the best system, the only system that works long term, and that everyone benefits from it. And the way to implement free trade is two steps. Again, not controversial. One, lower tariffs unilaterally to zero. Two, put political pressure, other pressure on other countries to do the same. But lead primarily by example. But even if they don't do it, again, all economic principle and all economic theory suggests that you are better off, and they are worse off. But it's not just economic theory. Moral theory suggests exactly the same. If we understand the role of government, we understand the role of morality, and we understand what self-interest actually means, it is in my self-interest. It's in all of Americans' self-interest, even the steelworker who loses his job. On principle, it is in our self-interest to unilaterally lower tariffs. Because yes, while the steelworker might lose his job, he is living in a free society. And there are multiple benefits of living in a free society, including the availability of other jobs, including the availability of cheaper products, a rising standard of living. So it's not, as the pragmatists would like us to believe, every decision we make out there, there are losers and there are winners. We have to trade off winners and losers. No. Anybody who's willing to use their mind, anybody who is willing to work for a living, anybody who's willing to be productive, who is interested in being productive, is willing to engage their mind and to be active out there in the world in order to achieve his goals, benefits from the principle of free trade, would benefit from a trade policy in the United States that unilaterally lowered tariffs to zero. With the one caveat that you don't trade with the enemy. But then let's be very clear on who the enemy is. Of course, we trade with the enemy all the time. Enemy like Saudi Arabia. So suddenly everybody gets upset about China because of foreign policy. I don't believe you. I don't believe you. You're using that as a pretense. Because if you really cared about foreign policy, you would be much more up in arms about Saudi Arabia than you are about China, because Saudis have actually killed Americans. The Chinese have not. Okay. Let's get to a little bit more of the philosophical issue here. Why think in principle? What is it about principles? What is it about the nature of reality and the nature of man that indeed requires us to think in principle? That you cannot survive, you cannot thrive as a human being unless you think in principles. And indeed, as Leonard points out in his essay, and proves in his essay, everybody thinks in principles. If you don't think in good principles, ultimately, you're going to adopt through lack of thought. So not everybody thinks in principle. Everybody uses principles. The principles of evil. Bad principles. Indeed, pragmatism is not a way human beings can live. It's impossible for people to live moment to moment, expediency based on the concretes in front of them. That's not how human beings function. It's not how human beings function because we are not programmed. We are not animals. We're not like the animals, right? We're not like other animals that have it all instinctually and they just need to observe the concretes of the moment and they know what to do. We don't know what to do. So we have a choice. We can act on our emotions. Doesn't lead to very good results. We can act based on what somebody else tells us. We can be complete second-handed. We can act based on what our leader tells us or what the tribe tells us or what somebody else tells us. Not a recipe for individual flourishing. Or we can engage the one tool evolution, nature has given us, the one tool that evolution, nature has given us to deal with the complexity in the world, to deal with the multitude of facts that exist out there, use that tool in order to survive. And that tool is our conceptual ability. That tool is our reasoning capacity. And what reason, what conceptual ability allows us to do is condense the units. Life is complex. There's just too many things going on. How do you figure out how to find food? How, you know, if you, 20,000 years ago. How do you figure out? You can't go by your emotions. You don't have any instincts to hunt. I mean, we're pathetic hunters. We have to figure it out. We have to invent. We have to discover. We have to think and strategize. And the only way to do that, because there's so many things going on, there's so many animals out there, and they're running in all kinds of directions, and you know, it doesn't make any sense if you just look at it at the perceptual level. If you just open your eyes and look, you actually have to think. Some animals eat this. Some animals like to go to water in the morning. Some of them like to go at night. Some of them, you know, come in the winter. Some of them come in the summer. You know, where do we put our traps? When do we go hunting? How do we organize the hunt? All of that requires conceptual knowledge. It requires not just to observe the concretes, but then to generalize from those concretes. And that's what a conceptual faculty allows us to do. It allows us to condense units. So Leonard uses the example of all men are mortal. Once you have that, you don't have to see somebody, you know, who looks a little different. Maybe they have a different color skin, or maybe they're taller, or maybe they have blonde hair that you've never seen before, and go, no, I wonder if he's mortal. I mean, once you've observed, once you've come to the conclusion, the generalization, the principle that all men are mortal, then if he's a man, if he fits that characteristic, then he is mortal. So generalizations are the way we think about the world, the way we use our conceptual mind to think about the world, to discover truth, to figure out how to survive, to structure our lives. The term, for example, man, captures every example of man out there, not just the men you've seen, not just the men you've observed. So that is the means by which we deal with reality. And indeed, reality is too complicated. It's too complex. There are too many things going on out there. And we do not have instinctual knowledge. We do not know how to cope with the bombardment of all this information and facts and complexity and reality that's out there to actually deal with it unless we think. And our thinking is enhanced by principles. Now, principles are basic generalizations, are fundamental generalizations. So the formal definition from Leonard, it's a conceptual statement, it's a principle, integrating a wealth of information about all kinds of concretes that we otherwise would be helpless to deal with or keep in mind. So we can't hold all these examples. I can't hold, well, it was okay to trade with Japan, it was okay to trade with China, it was okay to trade with South Korea, but what about Vietnam? You know, what about what's going on there? What about, I don't know, Germany? What about France? Right. You can't hold every country, the 220 countries in the world. I'd have to research every one. I'd have to figure out. I mean, all I have to do now is enemy, non-enemy, non-enemy free trade, enemy ban. That's it. Simple. It creates simplicity. Of course, it has to also be true if it's going to work. And you have to prove the principle of free trade, which I think has been done over and over and over again throughout history. And then you apply it. You apply it. So by reducing all these countries and all the trade relationships and all the different circumstances and all the concretes into one generalization, into one principle, the principle of free trade, for example, you make life a lot simpler. Indeed, it is the only way we have as human beings to simplify life and to make decisions. There is no other way. Again, the only other ways in which we can make decisions is using our emotions or following the leader. And they have to, you know, the leader has to make decisions based on something. He put his finger out into the wind, or use his principles. And his principles might be really evil principles. Ultimately, somebody is using principles out there because, and I think most people just follow, because we can't cope. Again, we can't cope with all the examples. The principle I think Donald Trump is following is the principle of what gets me votes, what gets me a win politically is what I should do. The principle is, you know, what can I make, what can I market to the American people as America first, make America great again. I mean, that's the principle. He'll do anything. He'll lie, he'll steal, he'll cheat if he thinks that he can sell it to the American people as making America great again or America first and therefore get their votes. All right, so somebody's saying Ayn Rand would not agree to a trading relationship with a communist or quasi-communist country. First of all, China is not communist, but let me also say you should read Ayn Rand because you obviously haven't. I would suggest going and reading what Ayn Rand had to write about Richard Nixon's trip to China and whether you would make that statement after you read that essay. Obviously, you wouldn't because Ayn Rand contradicts exactly what you just said. So, you know, be wary of, and generally I would say this, I mean, I'm wary. Be wary of saying Ayn Rand would or Ayn Rand wouldn't because you don't, right? Ayn Rand is a really sophisticated thinker, and it's very difficult to predict what she would or wouldn't have said. And she advocated, for example, for trading with China in the early 1970s because she didn't believe China was a threat to the United States, and she believed that Russia was, the Soviet Union was, and that China could be, in some sense, a bulwark against what was happening in against the Soviet Union. So, you know, again, I encourage you not to suggest what Ayn Rand would or wouldn't have said. I very rarely say Ayn Rand would or wouldn't have, unless she, you know, unless she's actually written specifically on a particular topic, or with all my studying, which is quite immense, I've come to the conclusion that it's pretty clear, and I usually have a lot of caveats even there because she was so unpredictable, and she was so much smarter than I am. So if I overuse that, then call me on it. Feel free to call me on it, because if I overuse the idea Ayn Rand would have, then call me on it, because the fact is that I don't know what Ayn Rand would have done in for three quarters of these issues. All right. Let me see. But for people who exhibit ignorance about the basic things that Ayn Rand have written, please don't claim that you know what Ayn Rand would have thought about stuff. I mean, I've at least really spent the last 30 years of my life studying, 40 years of my life studying her ideas in depth. You know, most people haven't, not because that's a moral flaw or anything in you. You just haven't. It's my profession. It's not yours. All right. So in every realm of human endeavor, we have principles. There are principles of physics, the principles of chemistry, the principles of agriculture. And in spite of what people would like to believe, there are actually principles of economics. And for the most part, in most of these areas, people accept the idea that there are principles. And this is part of the answer to the question of how to convince people. All of these areas are complex, are difficult, are hard. And you couldn't do physics without some basic principles. You couldn't do science without scientific principles to guide you. You couldn't do math. And the same is true in the humanities. Now, in the humanities, Leonard says, I mean, this is nice. In the realm of humanities, we are still in the age of pre-reason. I love that. That's a great term. We are still in the age of pre-reason, right? Pre-principles, pre-conceptual generalizations. But you need it in humanities more than in any other realm, because the humanities, by their very nature, are more complex than I think the sciences are, partially because they deal with human behavior and human beings. And we need it more than ever with regard to moral questions, because moral questions are hard. It's not, and yet moral questions are hard on the one hand, and yet we all need to address moral questions. Every single human being on the planet deals with morality every day, and they need guidance. And it is principles, fundamental truths that allow you to deal with them. Okay. Here's Leonard's definition of moral principle: is a basic conceptual statement enabling us to choose the right course of action. Right? Morality is about choosing the right course of action, avoiding the wrong course of action, choosing the right one. Principles are basic statements that enable us to do this. So they present us with a truth about this choice. They're not commandments. They're not arbitrary statements. Now, a commandment is a principle. It's just a bad principle. Because the way to deal with principles is good principles, true principles, useful principles have to be true. You have to be able to prove them in reality. You have to be able to use reason to prove that the principle is true, that it works, that it's efficacious. So in morality, we need principles because, again, life is complicated. Life is complicated. There are many, many options. There are many, many paths that people can take, and you can see it all around you. People violating moral principles all the time because, well, you shouldn't lie, but what about this case? And I can get away with it this time, or, you know, the pain I would cause myself and other people if I, you know, it's just not worth it. I mean, those kind of questions never occur to me, right? I've proven to myself over and over and over again that lying is bad, that honesty, which is the principle, honesty is a virtue, that deceiving myself and even deceiving other people, is never good. Right? And I don't need to think about it every single time a thought crosses my mind or something that I'm going to say might offend somebody or difficult for me or difficult for them, because I know that the principle is what makes my life livable. It would make my life simple. Otherwise, I couldn't cope. There's so many things you say in any given day. How do you know when to say the truth, when not to say the truth, what the calculus need to be, how to do the calculus, what parameters to include and what not to include? The principle, you prove once, just like in science, you prove it once and then you use it. Now, a false principle, if you did that, you would then use it and it would not work sometimes. And you would have to question then, you go back and question the principle. But if it works, a proper morality, Leonard writes, takes into account all the real life choices men must make, all of them, right? It tells us the consequences to expect from different choices. The consequences of lying, for example, the consequence of telling the truth. So it tells us the consequences to expect from the different choices facing us. It organizes all such information for us by selecting the essentials it integrates. It integrates all the data into a handful of basic rules that we can easily keep in mind, deal with, and live by. This is so essential for living, is to having a set of rules to live by because of the complexity of nature, because of the complexity of the world, and because we do not have instincts. We therefore have to have rational rules, rational principles by which we live, principles we've proven to ourselves, but then that we live by. And these are the principles we need to teach our kids. These are the principles we should expect other people to live by as well. Leonard writes, if you have no moral principles telling you which acts are right and which acts are wrong, or what is essential to judging a given situation and what is irrelevant, how are you to know what to do and what to avoid? How are you supposed to know? Again, what makes you feel good or feel bad? Emotions. What will appease people or not appease people? Again, in a sense, emotion. Or what people tell you, what the Bible tells you, what somebody tells you. Those are the only options in life. Live by principle, live by other people, or live by emotion. The pragmatic approach, the approach that tells you to go by the facts of the moments, the calculus of the moment, is a destructive approach. It basically cripples your mind. It floods it with data, and then you have to sift through that data and chuck out all the things that you can't handle right now until you get to some little concrete and you make a decision based on some irrelevant concrete. Whereas if you deal with it conceptually, you can hold all the information at once, because concepts hold a vast amount of information in every concept. So, think about, Leonard uses a bank robbery example, right? Should you rob a bank? And a principled approach to that would be, well, a bank is someone's property. Property is a requirement for human survival because one needs to produce and be productive and use one's mind. And that's a feature of productiveness. If you rob a bank, if you're violating the principle of a private property, if you're violating the idea of a human being's right to keep what he produces and he earns and what is a product of his mind and his labor, then you're legitimizing force, and you're legitimizing force against yourself as well as against everybody else, and society can't exist and everything falls apart. And we haven't even talked about getting caught or anything like that. But you're negating the principle that you need in order to survive yourself by violating somebody else's property. It all just falls apart. It all falls apart. And, if you're violating somebody else's rights, it's obvious that they're going to come after you because, so you're going to get caught. Something bad's going to happen to you. But beyond that, think about what it does to you philosophically. You're violating the principle that's required for you to live. You're legitimizing the use of force in society, which undercuts any kind of idea you hold about your own right to your own life. Now take a pragmatic approach. Well, which bank should we rob? Are we going to get caught? Will we not get caught? You know, are we going to go for a lot of money or a little bit of money? How much money is in the bank, right? I mean, it's not worth it for a little bit of money, but maybe a lot of money is worth it. And by the way, what are we going to do with the money, right? If we're good altruists, maybe we spend it on the poor. Maybe Robin Hood. That's what we should be. We should be Robin Hood. Rob from the rich and give to the poor. And, you know, but how do you decide? How do you decide if it's a good thing or a bad thing? You know, altruism would suggest maybe it's a good thing. We penalize the rich, give to the poor. But then there's how other people respond. But then there's, you know, there's a lot of money, and a lot of money could make a lot of people happy. But we might get caught. And if we get caught, the money's going to be returned, and that would be no good. And you could go on and on and on and on. There's no principle. So how do you decide? I don't know. The point is, there's no way to decide pragmatically. There's no mechanism. There's nothing to guide you. Whim or the wishes of other people. Your whim or somebody else's whim. That's it. Again, only three modes of operation. Go by emotion. Go by what people tell you. Or act on principle. And I think if you elaborate all that to people, hopefully they get it. Although, you know, I have to admit, I've obviously failed. Because there are people who listen to my show constantly and still think tariffs on China or on Mexico or on Brazil are a good thing. You know, so I have not convinced. I've tried over and over again, and I have not been able to convince many people to think in principle. Now, I'm hoping that if you go read Lena Peikoff's article, it will help. And if you send people to go read Lena Peikoff's article, it will help. But overall, I have to admit to being a little pessimistic right now, at least about my ability to convince people to think on principle. Here's another great statement from Leonard. The advocate of principles is the man who actually benefits from the vast data bank of life. He is the one who keeps in mind when making a decision the intricate network of interrelated factors, including the implications of his actions for the countless similar situations. He is the one who truly faces and deals with the complexity of life. Principles are exactly there to make it possible for us to deal with the complexity of life. To quote Leonard again, the people who reject principles reject the human method of dealing with complexity. But since they don't have the animal's means of coping, either they are left helpless. But since they don't have the animal's means of coping either, they are left helpless. And that's right. And what do you do when you're helpless? You go to the tribe, you go to the leader, or you follow your emotions. All of those are destructive. And he says, in the end, they have recourse only to war feelings or gang warfare. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. Today we're seeing the elevation of gang warfare in America into the presidency and into the way we relate to one another. It's all about which gang you belong. It's all about which tribe you belong. That is what is happening in America today. And he says, Leonard says, this is how our politicians are now deciding the life and death issues of economy and foreign policy. This was in 1988. It's 100 times worse right now. All right. There's a lot to say about principles and about what happens when you compromise on principles and who wins when you compromise on principles. But I encourage you to go read the essay, read Leonard and read Ayn Rand, who talks about this quite a bit. All right, let's do a few quick lighter topics. And of course, if you have questions on this, follow-up questions on this, feel free to ask them in the chat, but you have to, well, some people are saying on the chat that I did convince them. Cool. So there's hope. I can at least convince a few people. Not many, but a few. Thank you for that, Data Courier. Makes my day anytime I hear that I've convinced somebody of something, because at least I know I'm not wasting my time. So if you have a question on principles, then put them in bold in either Facebook or YouTube, and I'll try to get to it. I'll try to get to it here. Yeah. And somebody's asking, is free will about choice? Let me just say this. Yes, but free will is about the most fundamental choice. It's not about every little choice you make. It's not necessarily about raising your hand or not. Free will is about the fundamental choice that human beings make. And that fundamental choice relates to this idea of thinking, of principles. It's the fundamental choice of engaging your mind or not, using your reason or not, thinking or not, or in real fundamental terms, to focus your mind or not to focus your mind. Once you focus your mind and set it into motion, you know, you will think, and those thinking, that thinking will result in certain actions, will result in certain consequences. And yes, in that sense, the consequences are determined by the thinking that you're doing. But the act of thinking is a choice. And many people in the culture we live in today do not engage in that initial choice to think. They do not turn the switch on. They are not, you know, involved, and therefore, they're what I described before. If you don't turn it on, if you don't engage your conceptual faculty, if you don't engage in thinking, then there are only two modes by which decisions get made, choices, if you will, get made. One is you go by emotion. Two, you blind yourself and you just follow the leader or the group or the tribe or whatever. And that's exactly what happens, what you see out there, right? Is emotionalism and tribalism as reason descends, as people are not engaging their free will, are not engaging their minds, are not choosing to think, to turn it on, to focus. Okay. So, and that again is a uniquely, I think, objectivist perspective on free will. That it's not an issue of every little choice you make. I mean, every little choice you make is ultimately based on the fundamental choice you make, which is to think or not to think. And you make that every day. You make that every moment. You can turn your mind off. You can do it. You shouldn't. But you can. And when you do, you drift. You become like a sheep. You become, you revert. I talked a little bit about this a couple of days ago. You revert to the perceptual level, or what evolutionary biologists would argue, what evolution has programmed us, right? I don't know how accurate that is, but you revert to a non-thinking mentality, which is going by so-called intuitions or by emotions, by conceptual thought. You lose control over yourself. You lose control over your own life. In a sense, you lose control over your choices. All right, we got somebody on Facebook from Serbia, Alexander. You know, I'm coming to Serbia, so I'll be in Serbia in 2 weeks. 2 weeks minus 2 days. I arrive on Friday. I'm giving a talk on Saturday, and I leave on Sunday. But I will be, hopefully, I'll see you, Alexander, in Serbia. Don't miss my talk there. It's for the European Students for Liberty. All right. My advice to Serbian people is the same advice as everybody. You know, go study the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, and mimic it to the best of your ability. That is, mimic capitalism. Become as capitalist as you can. Be like Hong Kong. Be like America of the 19th century. Respect individual rights. That's the principle. All right, I'm going to get back to the questions that I promised to answer. I've got one more meaty question. Let's see. Okay, so somebody's asking about aesthetics, Greek works and their relevance in modern thought. And he's talking specifically about plays and epics, not exclusively philosophy. I think, so I'm not an expert on plays and epics of Greece. I'm a fan, but I'm not an expert. But I believe that there's huge relevance. I mean, the Greek plays and the Greek epics, like the Iliad and the Odyssey, deal with fundamental basic human questions and human issues, Antigone and Orpheus and, I'm going to butcher the name, so I'm not going to even try. But they all deal with fundamental basic ideas about human nature. This is what makes the Greeks so unique, is that they dealt with fundamental ideas about human nature and about reality and about the world and about how to live in the world. And what does it mean to be human? And what are the virtues? How to apply the virtues? Now, again, they don't necessarily do it right, but there's massive aesthetic appeal to reading something where these kind of questions are being dealt with, and you can learn from them. But again, art is not primarily didactic in the sense that you learn from it, but you can learn from it. But it's primarily spiritual. It's primarily gives you spiritual fuel. And watching a genius deal with these kind of questions is incredibly beneficial to your own psyche and to your own life. So I think it's very relevant. Of course, you know, you're saying not exclusively philosophy. Obviously, the philosophy is hugely relevant. The questions that Plato is asking are the same questions we must ask today. It's the same questions that all human beings in every era, at every point in time, must ask. Even if his answers are not true, the questions are relevant. And it's interesting to understand his answers and to understand them in the context of knowledge of his era. So reading Plato is incredibly valuable for the modern context. And then seeing Plato in the world today, seeing Plato in the thinking around us, and how Plato is influencing all the people around us, the philosophers, but people who even are not philosophers, the ideas of Plato are everywhere around us. And that's true of Aristotle, of course. It's true of the Stoics. It's true of many of the Greek philosophical schools. So yes, there's massive relevance for Greek today, yesterday, 500 years ago, and 500 years from now. The Greeks are eternal in that sense, because they dealt with fundamental human nature, fundamental questions about human nature and the nature of reality. They dealt with that in their art, and they dealt with that in their philosophy, and therefore people will always be reading the Greeks, at least civilized people. Well, I think it's ultimately a sign of civilization, the extent to which you take the Greeks seriously. I mean, Western civilization is Greek. It's not Judeo-Christian. It is Greek. It is Plato and Aristotle battling it out. That's Western civilization. And really, Western civilization is Aristotle. But it's the Greek way of thinking about the world. It's a secular way of thinking. It's a questioning of, and it's a challenging, and it's the idea of trying to inquire about the nature of reality, about the nature of man, qua man. That's what Western civilization is. Western civilization in modern times really starts with the Renaissance, which is the discovery, the rediscovery of Greeks. It doesn't start with Jesus. It doesn't start with the Pope. It doesn't start with the Reformation. It starts with the Renaissance. It starts with the humanist, with the thinkers, the philosophers coming out of the Renaissance. It starts with Michelangelo. And Donatello is before Michelangelo. It starts with the great artists of the Renaissance and the great thinkers of the Renaissance, the poetry, but also the philosophy. They're starting to think. They're starting to be secular. Even Descartes, as bad of a philosophy as he comes up with, trying. It's that trying that's so crucial. It's that engaging with the knowledge of the Greeks and then engaging with reality and with man's nature that makes Western civilization Western civilization. And that is that we learn from Greece. So yes, Greek works are relevant and always will be. All right, let's see. Objective. Okay, here's an interesting one. A lighter one. So and then we'll do one heavier one. Objectivism in birth, wedding. Well, maybe we'll end with this one and I'll save the other one for next time. So, well, yeah, I think we can end with this one and then maybe one other shorter one, and then I'll save the other one for another time because it's a little heavy and it's a little late. All right, I have to catch a plane tonight because I'm going, for those of you who don't know, I'm catching a plane tonight to Buenos Aires in Argentina. So I leave at 7 p.m. And I'm really excited about going. I'm doing, I don't know, five different events in Argentina, both in Buenos Aires and in Cordoba. And if you go to my Facebook page, you can find links to two of the big public events, which I hope you will all, if you live in Argentina, you will all join me at. One is a Intelligent Squared debate on inequality. And the other one is a talk I'm giving in the morality of capitalism in Cordoba. So if you live in Argentina, please come. You know, fly in from Mendoza and wherever you live from wherever you live in Argentina. Come and have a good time. Hang out with some objectivists. You know, it should be a lot of fun, and it should be exciting. So I'm eager to do those. Then from there, I go to Brazil, where I do I'm doing a 2-hour seminar on objectivism. Everything is in Porto Alegre, so you got to come to Porto Alegre. Porto Alegre is the center of the intellectual life of Brazil every April. But I will be doing a 2-hour seminar on objectivism on Friday. This coming Friday. I think it's from 6 to 8 or something like that, p.m. And then I will be speaking at a conference on the role of government. My talk will be on the role of government. It's a conference for students, and it's on the Saturday. And then I think on Monday, Tuesday, I'm doing to a couple of universities and then to a high school in Brazil. I spoke at this high school last time. This is all in Porto Alegre. So I hope you can, Porto Alegre, I'm pronouncing it horribly. I don't have my Brazilian accent. And then I'm speaking at this Liberty Forum that happens in Porto Alegre every April on Tuesday to 6,000 people on the issue of inequality. So that should be a lot of fun. 6,000 people, that's rarely do I speak to audiences that size. So that's a lot of fun. And, of course, I have a lot. I think the second most following on Facebook that I have is from Brazil. So U.S. number one, Brazil is number two. So I'm hoping that a lot of my Brazilian followers come to Porto Alegre, participate in some of the events, hang out. We'll probably be going out to dinners and doing all kinds of stuff. So I'm available. I'm just hanging out a lot of the time. So come over and, you know, we'll have a blast. Have a good time. Brazil is a fun, fun place. And the Brazilians, incredibly friendly and benevolent and joyous people. So I'm looking forward to hanging out with Brazilians. And then I fly from Brazil through London to Serbia. I'll be there on Friday or Saturday. So please, if you're in the Caucasus, please come and participate. If you're a student, it's going to be a big student conference. I think there's 600-700 people there. I'm talking about the relationship between free speech and free markets, why you need a free mind to have a free market. Then I go to Hungary, where I'm giving a talk in Budapest at a university. So if you're there, please come. And then I will be going to Kiev. I'll be doing two talks in Kiev at two different universities. Then I go to Tbilisi, where I'm giving a major talk at Free University. And you know, I'm looking forward to that. That should be exciting. I think the entire university is going to be there for the talk. And then I come back home. Those of you wondering if I'm doing something in Israel, I will be in May. So the week of May 20th, I'll be giving at least a couple of talks, one in Haifa at the Technion. I'll be advertising that on my Facebook page, the talk in the Technion in Haifa. And then I'll be giving a talk I'm trying to give another talk at Be'er Sheva University in the south. So if you live in Israel, you can come to that talk as well. And I'll be back in England in May as well, giving two talks at a Wales Art and Philosophy Conference. Should be pretty cool, right? Out in the middle of nowhere in Wales, so that should be cool. And I'm not sure where else I'll be giving. Right now, all my trips are gobbled in my mind, but. I mean, I would love to go to Africa. I need to be invited to come to Africa. Somebody needs to pay my way to go to Africa. And I would love to go to Africa. So anybody putting on a conference in Africa, anybody want to invite me to Africa, anybody want to raise some money to send me to Africa, I'm on a plane. I would love to speak in Africa, particularly South Africa, Nigeria. You know, Rwanda is really waking up and becoming, you know, where the horrific genocide happened, is waking up and becoming more cognizant of the idea of property rights. I think there's some other countries, Namibia, some other countries that are really moving towards more free markets. And I'd love to have the opportunity to speak to African audiences in Africa. I for one, Kenya, Tanzania, I for one am a big believer in that capitalism can work anywhere. any way it is tried, there's absolutely no reason it can't be. I've done safaris. People asking me about safaris. I've done safaris in South Africa years and years ago. It's been a long time, and I love them. I'd love to do a safari in Tanzania one day. All right, enough of this personal, you know, gibberish. Somebody's asking a question about objectivism in birth, wedding, and funeral events. What do objectivists do to celebrate weddings, to commemorate in funerals, and to celebrate birth? Is there something like Jews, have they mutilate the baby's penis? Christians try to drown the baby when they're born. Weddings are big, formal, fancy events that people go to, but there's a given ceremony, the given, you know, it's a standard thing. And funerals, what do people actually do in funerals? And I actually don't think this is a silly question. I think this is an important question, because I think that ceremony is important. I think wedding vows are important. They are commitment. It's a ceremony to celebrate one of the most important things you will do in your life. And celebration is cool. It's important. It's good for you spiritually to be engaged in celebrating achievement, celebrating certain positive commitments. You know, people go out to dinner after signing a contract. They raise a glass of wine. That's cool, right? Because they've done something important in their lives. So, I think that a wedding is so crucial. You've chosen somebody to spend the rest of your life with. You've chosen a soulmate. You're going to live together. You're going to, you know, maybe have children together. You're going to prosper and flourish together. Your lives are interlinked, interconnected in important ways. And to celebrate it, I think, is wonderful. And then how do objectivists celebrate? Well, they don't celebrate by compromising. They don't celebrate by having a religious wedding. They celebrate by creating their own, in a sense, ceremony. Now, what does a ceremony for an objectivist look like? You know, I think today the weddings tend to be pretty traditional, with the exception that the vows are actually, they tend to be secular, that they're in front of a judge or in front of somebody who is being deputized. I've performed some weddings to do the ceremony, and they write their own wedding vows, and they make them reflect their own spirit. Now, is that the ideal form of wedding ceremony? I don't know. I haven't given it that much thought, but somebody should. I think it would be cool if people did. And I think it would be cool if there was a repository of wedding vows written by objectivists, or written by rational people, written by people who want to celebrate their life together without kind of the sacrificial notions of religion or without the mysticism of religion. It would be nice if there was a database of good wedding vows that, it, you know, because a lot of people are not good at writing this kind of stuff. I'm not good at writing this kind of stuff. I would hate to do wedding vows. Luckily, you know, I got kind of a religious shotgun wedding. So quick wedding. But it was, you know, I had to do a religious wedding because it was the only way to get married in Israel. In those days, I think it's still true that you have to have a religious wedding for it to be recognized by the authorities in Israel. But if you want me to be a judge at your wedding, I'm happy to do it. It will probably cost you something if you're not a close friend, but I'm happy to do it. Just drop me an email. But it would be good if there was a repository of these things. It would be good if there was certain that people wouldn't have to think too hard about them if they didn't want to. It would be good if there were certain things that the judge or the person officiating said, kind of a standard text. You could change it. You could play around with it. But it would be good if there was like a standard text. And I think as objectivism will grow and as demand for these things increases, I think these things will evolve. There's no question in my mind that they will evolve. So take, for example, funerals. A friend of mine called me once, and it was, you know, a few years ago, and he said, you know, my son has died, and, you know, I don't know what to do. It's I don't know what to do. If you're a Christian, you kind of, there's certain sequence of events you do, there's certain people you call, there's a certain agency that takes care of it, there's certain things you say over the grave, there's a certain ritual about everybody come to the house or whatever, there's a certain path you go. If you're Jewish, you know, you sit Shiva, and there's certain prayers you say, and there's certain, you know, you don't, there's certain things you do. You grow a beard, you sit in mourning, and whatever. But what do you do as an objectivist? You kind of have to recreate. You here you are in mourning. Something horrible has just happened to you in life. And you have to invent this stuff. The beauty of having it all, in a sense, prearranged, having it prepackaged, is that at that moment when you cannot think because something horrible has happened, you can revert to the package. You can revert to something that is good. There's something that is consistent with your values. So it would be good if somebody came up with something around funerals. I think, I mean, ideally, it would be something that celebrated the life. I think a funeral should be a celebration of the life. You know, the idea of mourning, the fact that this person is no longer with us, but also at the same time, the reason you're mourning the fact that this person is no longer is because he or she was a value. And you want to celebrate the value that they represent and commemorate that value. Now, how do you do that? What do you say? What do you say over the grave? You know, do you... You know, what do you do about a plot of land, or what do you call it? You know, what do you do with a body? All of that stuff is, I think, valuable. It's valuable to have all that prepackaged and arranged for you so that when you're in that moment, you don't have to invent it. And the same is probably true with births. It would be cool to have some kind of, you know, I don't know. But at least the idea of celebrating a birth. I mean, I think one of the things I miss, you know, if you could call it missing, about religious holidays is the holiday. It's the getting together and celebrating. It's the party. And, you know, so I celebrate Christmas and I celebrate Thanksgiving. But, you know, Jews and Christians have lots of holidays. Right now it's Easter and they do a lot of, and it's Passover. And they do a lot of fun stuff. And it's cool and it's fun. So I think objectivists need to create holidays. I think it would be fun. Now, embrace some of the existing ones. I think Christmas is a wonderful holiday. Well, ultimately, we'll probably want to change the name. But there's a lot of stuff to celebrate. And we should. And we should find ways to be creative and fun about those celebrations. Not in that cultish, mimicish, you know, what would Ayn Rand do sense. But in a genuine... You know, let's celebrate something we really believe should be celebrated in a fun, original way. Let's celebrate values. Right. Yeah, I mean, some people go egg hunting for Easter. I find that whole thing, you know, just weird. Like Easter, eggs, Jesus on a cross, bunnies, eggs and bunnies don't really fit. The whole thing is like, whoa, you know, what the hell? This is the weirdest holiday ever. Like Easter is the weirdest holiday ever. You're supposed to celebrate, I guess, Jesus on a cross being reborn, you know, but you celebrate it with bunnies and eggs and chocolate and you know, and anyway, and then who the hell celebrates a crucifixion? That is bizarre. I mean, I never understood people who wear like jewelry with a cross on it. I mean, even if you're Christian, like really? Like it's a torture instrument. A cross is a torture instrument. They're walking around every day with a torture instrument around their neck, celebrating it. That's just weird. And but it goes to the heart of what Christianity is, which is the adoration of suffering. It's the adoration of torture. I know that Easter is a celebration of spring. I know that, and I love that. I'm just saying the way Easter is practiced is weird, and its combination with religion is weird. All right, I know somebody's asking, Yaron, should the person proposing go on one knee? I don't know. No. I shouldn't use myself as an example because that's not how I proposed. I was proposed to. So I don't think there's one way to do it. I think you can do it any way you want to do it. It would be great if, particularly the celebrations themselves, there were cool secular ways to do it. I couldn't do that in Israel because we had to have a religious wedding. But, you know. All right. But I think weddings should be something to have fun at. And I don't, I also don't like, I have to admit, I don't like that all the weddings are kind of the same, that there's a schedule. Yeah, like, you know, after half an hour, you raise the chair, they take the garter down, they take this, they throw the flowers backwards. I don't like that, you know, regimented sequence. Something original, something new would be nice. You know, that would be nice. So some originality. I'd like to see original weddings. You know, where the joy comes through. There's too much. I also find with weddings, there's too much, like, you spend 9 months preparing for these things. And it's hard work. And then the day itself is filled with stress. And then you're worried about, are the guests enjoying the food? And are they dancing? Are they doing this? Like, where's the joy in it? Right? Too many weddings are too regimented and too stressful. I think a wedding should be fun. Primarily fun. They should be a real celebration. The bride and the groom should enjoy themselves, should really be having a blast with people they love, not people they had to invite out of a sense of duty, but people they really love and want to spend time with and hang out with, and it should be just fun. That's what it should be, fun. And I find too many weddings are too conventional and too, even by objectivists who, yeah, they mix it up a little bit because the vows, but other than the vows, everything else is standard. And I can't understand organizing a wedding for 9 months. Beyond me. Beyond me. Why? I don't understand engagement. The whole process of engagement seems weird to me. Like you propose and you get married, or you propose and you figure out a date and you get married. But why a year in advance? Why does it take a year from when you propose to when? Now I'm just going off on this wedding thing, but why would you propose and then only get married a year later? You know, if you want to get married, get married. Let's do it, right? Wham, bam, bam. 2-3 weeks. You should be able to put it on, right? Get the, you know, maybe because people have to make travel arrangements, stuff like that. Okay, 3 months. 3 months. And that's just me. All right. All right, there's stuff here on finance, stocks, shadow banking, all good questions. All right, I'm going to get back to those. So we'll do a show on that, that set of questions. Then there's a question about the rule of law. Now, that's a heavy question. I'm not up for a heavy question right now. So we're going to get to the rule of law question. Maybe I'll do it on the road while I'm traveling. Maybe I'll use that as kind of a hook for one of the shows that I do in the next week. Now, I will be trying to do shows on the road. I apologize for the somewhat random schedule that it's going to appear. Whenever I can, whenever I have a good enough internet connection, whenever I have the time, whenever I have the energy, I will do a show. And I'll try to announce it in advance on Facebook. So follow me on Facebook. And I'll announce it on Twitter. So follow me on Twitter. And if you're subscribed on YouTube, you'll get to find out. So please subscribe in YouTube. If you get any value from these podcast videos, whatever, please, show your appreciation on Patreon by supporting the show, by making this show possible, by funding my marketing arm and all the people who help make this show happen, because that's where the money all flows, by creating those, all the different things that facilitate the show running smoothly. When I get back to Puerto Rico, we're going to put a green screen behind me, and we're going to see how that works. We're going to play around a little bit with green screens, and that should be fun. Yeah, somebody's suggesting I do the rule of law with Amy. Maybe that's a good idea. I think maybe the next show with Amy, if Amy's listening, we can do a segment on the rule of law. I'll send Amy the question as it was posed. It's a good question, because the rule of law is used in a variety of in two distinct different ways. And the relationship between the two, I think, is important and interesting. So we should talk about that. So, yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks, David. It's a good idea. If you want to ask questions, if you want me to cover particular topics, the best way to get that done is to make a contribution on Patreon and then offer topics for the monthly show in which I answer or address the Patreon topics. Again, you can also make a comment on Patreon and try to get me to answer a question or to deal with the topic off schedule. But please, Patreon, don't forget, or PayPal, if PayPal's easy. If you just want to do a one-off thing, PayPal's better. If you want to do a regular monthly thing, Patreon's better. Either way, you're on Brooks Show. PayPal.me, you're on Brooks Show. Patreon.com, you're on Brooks Show. Either way, it works. All right, go read Leonard Peikoff's essay on principles. Why I should anchor on principles. Just put that into Google and you will get it. It's on campus. It's free. One of the best essays in objectivism. It's really, really good. It really, really concretizes. I gave you a quick overview. I think you would benefit enormously by actually reading the essay itself. And anything by Leonard is worth reading. But this one's was a talk he gave. So it's not that long. It's short and incredibly valuable. All right, everybody. Great to have you on the show. When I come back to Puerto Rico, I'll also start interviewing people more. You remember I interviewed Greg Salamieri. That was a great show. And then Ilan Giono. That was a great show. You guys are watching those shows. That's great. I'm getting good viewership on both of those. And when I get back, I think I'm going to dedicate every Sunday to interview another objectivist intellectual. And we'll make that a regular feature of the Yaron Brooks Show. So look forward to doing that. Talk to you soon. Have a great week. And don't forget to share the show. If you liked it, share it. Bye, everybody.